The importance of comic wisdom from a religious perspective is dramatically revealed in the Apostle Paul's famous letter to the Corinthians. If anyone among you thinks he is wise by this world's standards, he should become a fool in order to be really wise. This morning's sermon is a reflection on Paul's high regard for the wisdom of the fool, the clown, the comedian. The objects of humor are boundless. Nothing is immune. Humorists have made the most sacred and intimate experiences the object of laughter. The comic satirist Ambrose Bierce defined birth as the first and direst of all disasters, and then described funerals as pageants whereby we attest our deepest respect for the dead by enriching the undertakers. Woody Allen is perhaps best known for his comic sayings about death. For example, I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. The difference between sex and death is that with death, you can do it alone and no one is going to make fun of you. Or, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it through not dying. What do I dislike about death? It must be the hours. I also love Woody Allen's comments regarding morality. The good people sleep much better at night than the bad people. Of course, the bad people enjoy the waking hours much more. When Mae West was asked in an interview if she really was a wicked lady, she replied, "Look, honey, if I was given the choice between two evils, I would choose the one I hadn't tried before." Another favorite of mine is when Groucho Marx was blackballed from a beach club because he was Jewish, and he patiently inquired, "Well, since my daughter is only half Jewish, could she go into the water up to her knees?" I'm a little reluctant to include the late George Carlin in my sermon this morning. Carlin, an ex-Catholic, has written the most biting humor about organized religion. And also, as many of you probably know, I can't use all of the words found in Carlin's comic diatribe against religion. We're in church, and so it comes slightly edited. George Carlin went to Catholic grammar school and high school up until his sophomore year when he walked out. In one of his comic skits, he says, "I've begun worshiping the sun for a number of reasons. First of all, unlike some other gods I could mention, I can see the sun. It's there for me every day, and the things it brings me are quite apparent all the time. Heat, light, food, and a lovely day. There's no mystery. No one asks for money. I don't even have to dress up, and there's no boring pageantry. And interestingly enough, I have found that the prayers I offer to the sun and the prayers I formerly offered to God are all answered at about the same 50% rate." Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day, and the invisible man has a list of 10 special things, commandments, that he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish, where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you. I want you to know, when it comes to believing in God, I really tried. I mean, I really, really tried. I tried to believe that there is a God who created each one of us in his own image and likeness, loves us very much, and keeps a close eye on things. I really tried to believe that, but I got to tell you, the longer you live, the more you look around, the more you realize something is screwed up. Something is wrong here. War, disease, death, destruction, hunger, filth, poverty, torture, crime, corruption, and then the ice capades. Something is definitely wrong. This is not good work. If this is the best God can do, I am not impressed. Results like these do not belong on the resume of a supreme being. This is the kind of crap you expect from an office temp with a bad attitude. And just between you and me and any decently run universe, this guy would have been out on his all-powerful ass a long time ago. Laughter is important everywhere. It is an integral part of life, a very important part, one that we could ill afford to lose. The Eastern religious scholar Christmas Humphreys has written, "Beware of the man or woman who will not laugh, for they take themselves seriously, and therefore there is no health in them. A sense of humor is a sense of proportion, of balance, of relative values, and the wise man or woman knows that few things matter much in life, and most don't matter at all. Away then with solemnity, for life is fun, an ever-renewed beginning, and all our suffering, our own, our neighbors, and our friends, is only the tragic element in a show which without humor and laughter would be very dull indeed." Well, this is sage advice, but unfortunately religion has traditionally neglected humor. There are, for example, no responsive readings, nor are there any hymns that sing the praises of laughter in our hymn book. Every year I try to do this and find myself completely at a loss in terms of finding something appropriate. There is nothing to be found to guide us in what to laugh at and what not. Somehow, religion has been thought too sacred for laughter. Nobody seems to have suggested that laughter itself might be a sacred gift. Religion is far too often deadly serious. The great religious humanist Robert Ingersoll justly complained, "Laughing has always been considered by theologians as a crime." I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said that angels can fly because they take themselves lightly, which is just what religion, for the most part, fails to do. It is my experience that religion, organized religion, tends to take itself seriously, that is, seriously in a bad sense. It is often ponderously somber. I suspect that the reason for this is that the church fathers know that robust humor could destroy the somber fabric of doctrine and creeds. The posture and pretension of organized religion, as George Carlin knew well, vulnerable to satire. And the church fathers are themselves somewhat laughable. The only way to keep people respectable is to stifle merriment. And so with deadly seriousness, religion loses sight of our laughable humanness. And subsequently, we who would take religion seriously lose sight of who and what we truly are. The popularity of the clown and the fool in the 20th century, for example, you may recall Picasso's many paintings and harlequins, the French painter George Wald's powerful clown figures, and, of course, the great comic figure of the modern period, Charlie Chaplin, and of course many others, all of these great artists rendered the clown and comic human figure as an icon of the human experience. The American poet William Empson describes the popularity of the clown in the 20th century as a reemergence of the medieval worldview, a view which perceived all men and women as fools in the eyes of God. So the fool was exactly every man and woman in the presence of God. The human fool, so ridiculous, ever contemptible to human eyes, was just the way any man or woman looked when inspected by the Creator. It is recorded in a biography of Charlie Chaplin that at the height of his career, Charlie paid a visit to his very pious mother in the aftermath of a triumphant tour. "Well, Mom, what do you think of all this nonsense?" he asked her. "It's wonderful," she replied. But if only you would put your talents in the service of the Lord, think of the thousands of souls you could have saved, Charlie. Chaplin's mother would do well to follow G.K. Chesterton's advice and, like the angels, take herself a little more lightly. She might then realize that comedy and humor are deeply rooted in faith, that laughter is a tool for salvation through which we recover our wholeness as human beings. Her son, the clown and fool, was truly a humble servant of the holy. In other words, a servant of life and love and truth. No doubt all of us have experienced the pleasure of watching the films of Charlie Chaplin. It is the figure of this little downtrodden and chivalrous man in big baggy trousers and wrinkled out-of-size shoes that best captures the comic vision. Chaplin's tramp provides us with an image of the lonely, unprotected individual clinging to his humanity amid the impersonality and dehumanization of the modern world. Charlie's tramp represents the little man who, amid the dreary facelessness of men and women, completely involved in the rituals of a money-driven culture, insists on behaving as though his fellow human beings were still human. As a result, he was perceived by them as a scandal, an utterly absurd little scandal. He was never regarded as a serious threat, and certainly his eccentricity was never perceived for the profoundly subversive thing that it was. He was simply a charming, though utterly irrelevant fool. Yet as erratic and unpredictable as the tramp's behavior was, he was never ridiculous. One wants to say that he was touching, for everything he did was so utterly human, even his pranks and mischief. One feels that here is a man, a wonderfully eccentric human being, living out his life, a little hobo whose every gesture somehow manages to redeem the human image by revealing how beautifully mysterious life would be if unencumbered by the pursuit of money and social status. When Charlie sets out to walk to the horizon in the film The Tramp, we feel that here is the real human being itself, clothed only in the awkward innocence of essential humanity. Let me recall for you the particularly memorable allegorical film City Lights, a movie in which Charlie strikes up a relationship with a rich man on a drunken spree, who, taking a fancy to Charlie, invites him to live with him in his great mansion. But when his host recovers his sobriety, he is so repelled by the little man that he flings him out of the house. And the fun of the movie arises out of the comical alternations of the rich man's drunken acceptance and embrace and then somber rejection of Charlie's innocent friendship. All, of course, to Charlie's utter befuddlement. In the allegory of the film, the rich man is a representative of conventional social values and mentality, completely captive to a materialist ethic. When the rich man is half intoxicated, he cannot resist the charming gaiety of the little fellow who regards his material affluence as requiring altogether too much trouble to make it worth scrambling after. One suspects that the rich man embraces Charlie in his drunkenness because the lackadaisical little tramp is in some ways his own deeper, truer self, the real self which he has repressed and for which he secretly yearns. But in his moments of sobriety, he rejects Charlie, expels him from his house. Again, one suspects that he does so because the tramp, with his comical, smiling irony, engenders in him the remembrance that to be a true man or woman, to be a great material success are not one and the same thing. And this is the fact he has not the courage to face. So he finally drives the clown out of his life, since Charlie evokes memories with which he has not the spiritual resources to deal with. Charlie Chaplin spoke for all comics and humorists, and no doubt for the audience as well, when he said, "The theme of life is conflict and pain. Humor is the subtle discrepancy we discern in what appears to be normal behavior. Through humor, we see in what seems rational the irrational, and what seems important, the unimportant. It also heightens our sense of survival and preserves our sanity. We must laugh in the face of our helplessness or go insane. Chaplin's understanding of humor is captured in a poem by Yvonne Glasgow called The Clown. Life drains the living energy from my soul. This pain that I keep feeling only has one goal, to rip me to shreds and break me down. My only laughter comes from the thoughts of a clown. When she is within me, I can smile again. But when she hides, all I can see is no end, no end to this pain and misery that life feeds me. Darkness and clouds of black are all I see. The clown within, she stands up tall, even when I feel as if I'll fall. It is her that keeps me living each day. She keeps the demons and spiders at bay. Her smile is what shines through my tears. She tries her best to fight off all my fears. Another personality, a mask that I wear, she is there in my head when I feel no one else will care. Jokes to make them laugh while I am dying inside. Without her, so many things I couldn't hide. But the mask helps to cover up all of my grief, and the clown gives my mind and soul some relief. A break from the harshness that reality brings. With her in my head, my spirit sings. Tears of a clown, but the tears are from me. The clown is what dries the tears so that I can see that someday life will be much greater. Must have the patience to wait for later. So in my head, the clown keeps sentry and hopes to block out misery's entry. And until the grim reaper takes my hand, walking me into the light to some promised land, the clown will be at my side. She will be my eternal guide. And even when life gets too rough to bear, the clown and her smile will always be there. A number of years ago, I celebrated in a memorial service the life of my friend Herb Paskey when I was at the North Shore Unitarian Church in Deerfield, Illinois. What I remember most about Herb was his wonderful, dry sense of humor. Even his appearance was clown-like. Herb had a big face and a big head, a bald head with frizzy hair around his ears. And there was the small, bright red oxygen tank he always towed behind him. His heart was growing old, and he had only a little time left. The oxygen tubes reached up into his nose, but this is how he appeared every Sunday morning. Every time we met, there was, if not a joke, always a comic remark. I think Herb wanted to remind me and the rest of the world to lighten up. In the face of his own mortality, Herb's advice was, please, please, Gary, life is painful enough as it is. Please, lighten up. I, by both personality and vocation, being a minister and all, can get a little heavy at times. This somber sensibility seems to come with the long black robe I wear on this occasion. The world can be overwhelming when viewed from a somber and tragic perspective. The wars, the hunger, the suffering. What I found so refreshing about Herb was his comic worldview reminding me to not take life so seriously. For example, in our All Souls Sunday service on the first Sunday of November, which we will be celebrating in 2 weeks, we would commemorate the beloved dead of our congregation and invoke the names of those who died in the last year. On that occasion, I often read the 39th Psalm. You may recall the 39th Psalm begins, "Unnameable, unthinkable God, Lord of the dead and the living, teach us how transient we are and how fragile is everything we love. For all of us flash into being as insubstantial as a breath. Our lives are a fleeting shadow, then we vanish into the night." The psalm ends, "Turn toward me, touch my spirit, stay beside me until the moment when I must step out into your final darkness." Well, 1 year following the All Souls service, Herb approached me pulling his little red oxygen tank on wheels, muttering, "Nothingness, non-existence, black emptiness, and final darkness." Looking me straight in the eye, he asked me if he had it right. Me, confused, replied, "Herb, what are you talking about?" And he says, "Gary, I was listening closely to you this morning, and I'm planning for my future." Following a sermon on love and death titled Love is Stronger Than Death, Herb pulled me aside and said to me, Gary, let me get this straight. I was listening to everything you said this morning about love and death, and I'm struggling here. You're telling me to love is to suffer. To avoid suffering, one must not love. But then one suffers from not loving. Therefore, to love is to suffer. Not to love is to suffer. To suffer is to suffer. To be happy is to love. To be happy, then, is to suffer. But suffering makes one unhappy. Therefore, to be unhappy, one must love or love to suffer or suffer from too much happiness. Is that the point you were trying to make? And I rolled my eyes and laughed, and I said, Herb, I think you summarized my sermon very well. In the last moment of Herb's life, I was told a chaplain visited Herb and attempted to counsel him in response to his illness and suffering. And he said, he suggested something to Herb, something along, perhaps God, as he had done with Job, was testing us. To which Herb, without missing a beat, responded, if he's going to test us, why doesn't he give us the written version? In response to death, I suspect Herb, who was an investment counselor, would tell his clients and all of us this sage advice. The key is not to think of death as an end, but as more of a very effective way to cut down on your expenses. We are all bearers of some message regarding the meaning of life, and Herb's message was to lighten up, to not take ourselves so seriously that we lose sight of who and what we truly are. We are only, in rare moments, heroes and heroines. Most of the time, we are simply imperfect, earthbound creatures stumbling and sometimes farting as we make our way through life. This is the truth the comic declares to the world and the truth he awakens in us, a recognition of what, in fact, our true status is on earth. He or she reminds us not to be afraid to acknowledge that we are only human, that our residence is not in the heavens, but here on earth. The comic reminds us to examine our lives with a sense of humor and to recognize all of the many gimmicks and the false perfections we use to evade a frank acceptance of our humanness. I don't know that Herb and other people like him are conscious of their bearing the wisdom of the fool in the world, but this was the gift I and many others received from him. I didn't have the opportunity to share this final joke with Herb before he died. I think he would have appreciated it. On Saturday, the minister drove to the hospital to spend time with his terminal friend and church member. I'm really sorry to be the one to tell you this, but I spoke with the doctor, and I was told this is your last day to live. The church member replies, Jesus, then I'm going to ask all my friends to come here for a final party. We'll have a gourmet dinner, champagne, and dancing girls will party till dawn. Come and join us, Pastor. And the minister replies, that's easy for you to say. I'm preaching tomorrow. You don't have to get up in the morning. On the deepest level, laughter is a religious affirmation. When we move into the deeper incongruities of life and encounter the inherently tragic character of human existence, the inevitability of suffering and death, humor evolves into faith. The same sense of wholeness which enables us to laugh at the superficial incongruities of existence expresses itself at this deeper level as a faith. Capable of integrating, if not resolving, our tragic encounter with time and mortality. I agree with the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr when he wrote, humor is a prelude to faith and laughter is the beginning of prayer. In the face of all discouragement and despair, all disappointment and destruction, laughter is a great restorative. A sign that we can still laugh and so still live and so go on. The late Unitarian minister A. Powell Davies wrote of the importance of laughter, laughter is hope's last weapon. In the presence of disaster and death, we laugh instead of crossing ourselves. Perhaps better stated, our laughter is our way of crossing ourselves. Where laughter and hope have disappeared, humans have ceased to be human. As long as there is laughter, there is hope. And so there you have it. Woody Allen, Charlie Chaplin, the Marx Brothers, Louis C.K., George Carlin, Monty Python, Richard Pryor, Lily Tomlin, Gilda Radner, and all the many, many other comics and clowns lead us with their comic vision along the path of folly, descending into the mundane world of the human creature, moving into all the corners of our human habitation, finally leading to joy, a deep joy that we win only after we have consented to journey through this familial world of the earth, which is our home. And by doing so, they help to restore us to our humanity. They help us to uncover our absurd weaknesses and ludicrous contradictions, which is their salvation and our salvation as well.